case is Orla Lambert versus Philip Watson, Jenner, Architects, and Leon, and some other friends that I brought back out. 06-15-72. Before we begin, and since we don't start the clock yet,
sure.
We have four principal briefs here. Two of them have been labeled as containing confidential matter, and there's a lot of material that has been so labeled. That's always a difficulty on appeal because we have to ask questions in public, and we have to write an opinion, and we notice that a lot of the so-called confidential material was in the district court's opinion. So we'd like to ask you all whether anything here is really confidential and why.
Your Honor, Jack Blumenfeld for the plaintiffs. I think one of the briefs that's under seal is our opening brief, our initial brief, and there is nothing in there that has to be kept under seal. I apologize. The reason that it was sealed was because it was filed before we could coordinate with the defendant's counsel about what information they wanted to keep confidential, but there's no reason that anything in there has to be kept confidential.
Any different comments?
No, we agree, Your Honor, we don't press any confidentiality. Sir.
Thank you very much. Mr. Blumenfeld, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jack Blumenfeld for the plaintiffs. May it please the court, on a motion for summary judgment, the district court cannot disregard relevant evidence, can't weigh evidence, and here the district court did both. As a result, we were not given a chance to try our infringement claim, even though we had two experts who testified that there was infringement in their opinion, and even though TEPA's own evidence was consistent with those opinions. And in holding that Warner Lambert couldn't try to prove that TEPA's gabapentin has less than 20 parts per million of an anion of a mineral acid, the court, the district court, disregarded several pieces of crucial evidence, and I would like to address two of them briefly. And first, it's undisputed that before the 482 patent issued in 2000, TEPA's gabapentin had less than 20 parts per million of total chloride. It had 6 to 7 parts per million. That's an undisputed fact. It's undisputed that after the patent issued, TEPA changed its process in the spring of 2000, and that the process, the part of the process where the mineral acid was removed, using an excess of TBA, was not changed, and therefore the process did not increase the acidic chlorides. TEPA's own data showed that, and if you look at the chart that's on our opening brief, page 24, it shows that the pH before the change, after the change, was in the same range, didn't change. Based on that evidence, our chemistry expert, Professor Bartlett, testified that the acidic chloride levels did not increase in TEPA's gabapentin starting in 2000. Now, the district court mentioned Warner Lambert's contention on that point twice in its opinion, but it didn't address it anywhere in the analysis.
Was there any sort of Daubert motion below?
There was no Daubert motion below, and in fact, as we put in our reply brief, Your Honor, there was a representation by the defendants that they were only challenging the limits of precision. They were not challenging the validity of the data.
They seem to go beyond that on appeal, I suppose.
They have gone beyond that on appeal, but they expressly told Judge Liflin to ignore any challenges to validity because those created fact issues and were not appropriate on summary judgment. But we put out all of the data also on the TEPA process, the 6 to 7 parts per million, the change, which didn't change the excess of TBA, in our opening brief in this court, and none of that was contested in the answering brief either.
Let me just posit something to you. Suppose that I agree with your claim construction And I understand that you tested 5 Teva samples post-process change. And I'm looking in particular at the appendix at 1659, which is the chart that shows the titrated pH and all the way through. And so by my calculation, 4 of the 5 samples could not possibly, if we assume that you did right what you say you did and all of that, 4 of the 5 samples could not possibly have more than 20 parts per million of acidic chloride.
That's correct, Ron. In fact, I think all 5 couldn't possibly have.
Well, the fifth one, hold on. The fifth one, though, if we agree that it's plus or minus 5 error rate in parts per million, which I think your expert, Mr. Bartlett, was the one who suggested that's what it is, plus or minus 5. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. So the fifth one, it seems to me that if you add plus or minus 5 ppms there, it could possibly be over 20.
If you look at our opening brief at page 36, we graphed the plus or minus 5, and I believe even for that, with the plus 5, it falls below 20.
But it does. Certainly it's like taking, it's like right there below 20.
Right. But certainly taking your point, there can be no question that 4 of the 5 samples were below 20.
And so here's my question to you. At what point do you think we ought to say that you have established your burden such that summary judgment shouldn't be granted? Suppose in this case it's 4 of 5, you think that's a clear showing if I say 4 of 5. What if it was 1 of 5?
Oh.
I know there's not a fact, but...
No, I understand, Your Honor, but what we had here was more than one thing. And what we had to show was that there was a genuine issue of fact because it was their motion. And what we showed was, one, that Teva had 6 to 7 parts per million and the process change didn't affect that. And on the point Your Honor's making...
I know all the other points you're going to point me to, but I just want you to focus then on just my little hypothetical, which I know is not these exact facts, but I'm trying to understand where to draw the line in that regard. And I know you're pointing me to the other evidence
right.
saying
no.
you don't have to make this decision.
And I understand
that. I appreciate that, but I just want to know, if it was 1 of 5, do you think that would have been enough?
I think where we are is that if the evidence was sufficient that a chemist could give an opinion that Teva's gabapentin had less than 20 parts per million, that would be sufficient. We clearly had that here. I think we would be in a situation.
Mr. Bartlett had testified via deposition or transcript or whatever that because 1 of the 5 showed Teva's product below 20 parts per million, that he concludes, therefore, there's infringement.
Well, at least my understanding, there's nothing that requires that in order to prove infringement, that it infringe 100% of the time. That if we could show that some of Teva's gabapentin was infringing, that would be sufficient to prove infringement. There might be remedy issues that flow from that, but if you prove that there's infringement some of the time, that's sufficient. And so I think if there was 1 of 5, yes, we could put on an infringement case. Luckily for us, we don't have that situation here. I think we have a much clearer case. And that the point that you made, Judge Moore, was the second point I was going to make on evidence that wasn't considered, because on the pH testing, Judge Liflin looked at one hypothetical example of 18 parts per million and did plus or minus 5. The actual evidence wasn't 18.
Did he do plus or minus 5 or just plus?
Well, he did. He said 13 to 23. It could be anywhere between 13 and 23, but he said it could as easily be over 20 as below 20. That putting aside whether that's correct or whether it's more likely than not, if it's 18, that it's below 20, as Judge Moore said, 4 of these 5 samples were way below 18. 3 of them fell in the range where the pHs were higher than the standard for 6 parts per million.
He said samples that show 18, as you say, aside from whether 18 is less than 20, are indistinguishable from samples containing 23 or more. But according to the margin of error, they could also be 13.
It could also be 13, and I think one of the points we made in our brief, and I think it's correct, is that we didn't have to prove this to a certainty. We had to prove it to a preponderance of the evidence, and it was sufficient to determine to prove that it was more likely than not. Even at 18, we think it's more likely than not. But even if you take into account the limits of precision for 4 of the 5 samples, there is, you know, there is no question that they were below 20. The third point that I wanted to make was, in addition to disregarding that evidence, the district court did weigh evidence because Teva put in its subtraction test results through its expert. We put in our comparative pH tests. And Dr. Bartlett testified that, in his opinion, the pH test was a better way to go than the subtraction test because you didn't have to make any assumptions. It was clean. You tested something. You didn't have to assume certain things were there and not there. Both Dr. Bartlett and Dr. Davies, our analytical chemist, opined from the pH testing that Teva's gabapentin had less than 20 parts per million of an anion of a mineral acid. Nothing equivocal about their testimony. And what Dr. Bartlett said, and this is at page 1455-56, was that the pH test results flatly contradict the subtraction test results that Teva used. This was a classic battle of experts, and where both of our experts testified that Teva samples have less than 20 parts per million, even within the limits of precision, and the judge, on summary judgment, disregarded that and accepted the subtraction test. And under the Glaxo, Abbott, Sun Tiger cases from this court, which we cited in our brief, you can't grant summary judgment of non-infringement by weighing one side's expert testimony over the others, and that's what we believe happened here.
Are you saying that summary judgment in your favor should have been rendered, or that it should go back for a trial?
No, we didn't move for summary judgment, and there were points on which the defendants said that they would challenge our data. They said they were not challenging it on summary judgment, but that they would challenge it if we got past the summary judgment.
The isoelectric
point never came up below, but there were other issues on which they said they were going to challenge the validity of our data.
Just out of curiosity, I realize this is not your appeal, and they didn't actually make an appeal, but I've been trying to figure out, do I have to decide the adjuvant's claim construction issue depending on how we come out on the first issue? If we were to rule in your favor on the first issue, would I have to reach the second issue, or do you think we have to reach both of them? I'm guessing I know what they're going to say. I'm just curious what you think.
No, and we don't think that you have to reach the adjuvant issue, assuming that you reverse on the burden of proof issue. And there are a couple reasons for this. One, this is a Rule 54B judgment, and there's nothing about the adjuvant issue that relates to the burden of proof issue.
Well, he certified the order for the adjuvant claim construction and the summary judgment of non-infringement from Apotex, which is not in the case anymore. It was all certified up to us, so.
But on the issues that these defendants have, that was not, the denial of summary judgment on the adjuvant issues that they're raising were not part of the 54B judgment, but maybe more importantly, they're not dispositive of the case, because even on the titanium dioxide, not all of the accused products use titanium dioxide. On the modified maize starch, only one of the many accused products uses what they claim to be modified maize starch.
As a matter of judicial economy, it was argued, and the claim construction was decided. And if we were to find in your favor, the issue would still be live, and wouldn't it aid the parties as well as judicial economy to decide it?
Well, on the claim construction, it might. There are factual issues that will be involved, on infringement in any event.
Which we wouldn't decide in any event. We'll save the rest of your time.
Thank you.
You'd like to do that?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Lee, you have determined to split your time with Mr. Howe.
Yes, sir.
And it's between you, and any time you run over is at his expense.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the point about the Teva process before and after the change. I think this issue was dealt with substantially below. The problem is that the Teva pH measurements, everybody agrees, were too imprecise.
Everyone agrees? I don't think that Mr. Blumenfield, if he was to get a chance to come right back up right now, would agree. Am I wrong about that? Or are you saying that he agreed that the pH was too imprecise because you said everybody?
I'm saying that the experts below testified that the method that Teva used to determine pH was too imprecise to be able to tell what the
acid
chloride level was.
I cut you off prematurely.
And in fact, those values ranged all over the place within a relatively small range, but they were not dispositive of themselves, and that's why plaintiffs had their experts conduct some new tests.
So are you suggesting, just so I understand where you're going with this, that in the absence of a precise measurement of parts per million, there can be no proof sufficient to overcome summary judgment that the potentially infringing products do in fact infringe? You know, are you saying that if they can't prove the exact number, they can't survive summary judgment?
I'm not saying they have to prove an exact number in all cases. What I am saying is when the imprecision is very great, it's obvious you can't use such numbers, and I believe that is true of the kind of routine laboratory test measurements that Teva made during its process controls.
I also believe that it's true
of the testing that was performed by defendants' experts, which they admitted was imprecise to the order of 10 parts per million when you are trying to measure a number which is only 20 parts per million.
When you say imprecise to 10 parts per million, you mean plus or minus 5, right?
That's not exactly what the defendant's expert said, but that's the way the judge construed it, and we're willing to stay with that for the purpose
of... Okay, well, would you agree then that 4 of the 5 Teva samples that they tested showed a pH that would put the parts per million, even plus 5, below 20?
I would not, Your Honor. I would agree that if you start at a pH of 7.06 and you draw this nice curve that they have on page 36 of their appeal brief, that's what it looks like, that one of the samples is indeterminate and four of them fall within the 18 ppm. But it all depends on what you compare it to.
But you raised that issue below.
We did raise
that. Not for purposes of summary judgment. You said, and I have the site right here, your admission that you would not challenge the validity of their pH testing for purposes of the summary judgment motion. So I understand your isoelectric point completely. It may be valid, may not be valid. It's a fact question for someone below to figure out. But you kind of waived that for summary judgment purposes, if I understood it.
I'm not sure I understand that, but I certainly don't agree that we waived it. We are not challenging the validity of the patent. What we're challenging is that the test method that they used was imprecise, and I'm trying to show by reference to the zero point.
Okay, here's your admission on page 9307. First, Teva's experts vehemently dispute. They don't just dispute, they vehemently do so.
Yes.
The validity of the data he relies on, but I want to ignore that dispute. Those factual issues are in dispute, but should not be part of this motion, and you can ignore them. So you're telling the judge below, ignore the dispute over the validity of their pH curve for these purposes.
No, Your Honor. I think what we were saying is we do not dispute the numbers that he got. We don't dispute that. There's absolutely no dispute that whatever numbers they reported, that those are the numbers that they got, and we're willing to accept that. What we're not willing to accept is that those numbers are valid numbers for comparison in this particular very imprecise pH test.
And that's all fact. You may be
right.
Yes. You may not be right, but this is summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Everything you're arguing to me right now is fact.
They are facts, Your Honor, but they are facts that go to whether or not this particular kind of pH testing could ever be the kind of evidence that a jury could accept and make a reasonable judgment of. What we're saying is not that you should pick 7.06 the way they did, or pick 7.19, which was an acceptable number, or 7.14. What we're saying is, because it makes all the difference in the world which number you pick, and because there is nothing in the record, the prosecution history, the patent, anything which suggests what the number is that you start with, and you couple that with the imprecision, the admitted imprecision of this test, you wind up with a test which the judge was completely right is not capable of proving infringement of the defendant's products.
Well, the 0.13 pH dispute was not before the lower court, was it? When he made the summary judgment motion.
We
so why should we even be considering that? It wasn't raised below. It wasn't decided upon below or a court of appeals.
We argued below, Your Honor, that there was an improper comparison between the defendant's products and not the patent, but the plaintiff's product. And the judge took that in its very narrowest sense and said, it doesn't matter whether the test, the sample of neutral gabapentin was plaintiff's product or whether it was somebody else's product. I'm not disputing that. We're not saying it's because it was their product. We're saying it's because that had nothing to do with the patent. That particular sample could have taken any one of a number of samples, and because of the imprecision of the test method, it all depends on what sample you pick. This particular sample could never have been used by a reasonable jury, and the reason is because it was not what Warner Lambert calls it over and over, a gold standard. It was not a standard at all. It was not available to any of the defendants for testing purposes before this litigation. Still not available.
Was that issue raised below the district court?
That issue of whether it was available was not raised below. But the issue of whether there was a proper comparison to that particular sample that was raised below, and we believe that the that we are allowed to raise alternative grounds in support of the same argument that that they failed their burden of proof.
Can it's I ask all, you the adjuvant's question, or are you guys splitting the time?
No, the adjuvant question is mine, Your Honor.
Okay, so do I need to reach this issue, depending on how I come out, either way? What is your position on whether we need to reach the claim construction issue vis-a-vis adjuvants?
If you support the Judge Liflin's opinion, you do not need to reach the adjuvant issue. If you do not support it, I believe you do have to reach the adjuvant issue because it is dispositive as to all, I think, but one of the samples, and that was a capsule sample.
The distinction between whether we support the judge's decision or not, why don't we reach it in either event? Well, it depends upon whether we're going to remand and send it back.
That's my point, Your Honor.
In which case, we should deal with it either way.
If you're going to remand, I think it's proper and it's probably efficient to consider the adjuvant argument now. And I would just like to say on the adjuvant argument that we think that the judge correctly determined that titanium dioxide is an adjuvant and it's an excipient. It's one of the eight no-no adjuvants that you can't put into a formulation. Where he erred was saying that titanium dioxide in a capsule shell or in a tablet coating was not an adjuvant for purposes of claim 7 because it was not intimately admixed with the gabapentin. And this was an error for at least four or five reasons. First of all, the record is completely barren of any reason why excipients in coatings or shells should be excluded. There is nothing in the specification, in the claim, in the prosecution history. Judge Liflin points to nothing.
I definitely understand your point about the mix, whether it's in the mix, basically. And here's my question. Could it still be in the mix, despite the fact that it's in the shell, or a coating around the shell, as I understand some of the products use? It all depends on when it's digested in your stomach, before it reaches your bowels and takes effect. It all depends on whether or not it's going to cause more than 0.2% instability in the gabapentin. Isn't that the issue?
No, I don't think it is, right.
So in the, help me then.
In the Apotex decision below, which was not appealed, and so is the law of the case, the judge found that any amount of any one of those eight adjuvants, including titanium dioxide, any amount, was removed the formulation from the scope of that claim. And what we're saying is we have some of this stuff in our
claim. Any of those... Did he say any of them anywhere or any of them
no,
in
the mix? He did not reach the issue of where they were. He just said, if you have any of these eight in any amount that they are, that formulation does not fall within the scope of the
claim. And here's why maybe we shouldn't reach that issue either, because maybe that part of it is infringement and not claim construction. And tell me if I'm wrong about this, but isn't it possible that if you put these things in your coating, they may or may not, depending on how the product is digested, affect the stability of gabapentin. And that seems to me to be part of the infringement analysis.
I understand that point, Your Honor. But Judge Liflin, in his decision, which was not appealed, went beyond that. He said, I don't have to consider whether any of these materials actually affect the lactan formation in the capsule and the tablet. They have disclaimed any formulation which contains those excipients, and therefore, it doesn't matter whether it's a minuscule amount, de minimis amount, any amount will remove that claim, that formulation from infringement. That was not appealed. That is the law of the case. Now, what we're saying is the evidence shows, at least with respect to tablets, there is sufficient evidence in the record that shows with respect to tablets, Warner Lambert itself tested titanium dioxide as a colorant in the tablet coating, found that it was inconsistent with stability, and instead put talc in their tablet coating. That's part of the record. Judge Liflin relied on it. And on that basis, he should have said, well, you know, titanium dioxide in a tablet coating is an excipient for purposes of Claim 7. The only evidence that he points to for why titanium dioxide in a coating could not be considered to be an adjuvant has to do with capsule shells. And that evidence we submit was improper because all he was saying was Neurontin capsules contain some titanium dioxide. Therefore, that's not how I should construe the claim. He should not have done that. He should not have looked at what the commercial product was in order to determine what the claim was. I've used up almost all my time that I want to.
You were answering the question, so we'll give Mr. Hogg 5 minutes, and if needed, we'll add a couple of minutes to Mr. Blumenfeld.
So, okay.
In other words, you've got more than 10 minutes.
I understand. I would point to the Trondel Declaration, which Judge Liflin refers to, where he said talc had 20 times less of an effect on lactam formation than titanium dioxide. They also include gelatin, which is an ingredient in capsule shells, in the list of ingredients in the Trondlin and Gebhardt declarations. And I would say that you know, his in the Gebhardt declaration, it's one of the categories of excipients which Gebhardt says is relevant is coloring agents. Well, the coloring agents are only going to occur in the coating or in the capsule shells. I think that there's no way that these claims
you're not using the colleague's term, you understand.
I understand, Your Honor. The other issue that I wanted to talk with was our alternative argument about the construction of the claim to 20 parts per million of a mineral acid, but I will cede that time to my colleague. Thank you.
Yeah, you've used 15 minutes, so we'll give you about 2 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to address, of course, the question of claim construction of anion of a mineral acid. Key to this whole case, central to everything. Down below, the court construed the term precisely as Warner Lambert asked it to, and said that anion of a mineral acid means anion derived from the mineral acid. The court imported process limitations into that phrase. And was in error. The claim term, the court said, was ambiguous in the claim. And in fact, at 886 says it supports both sides' position. The court then went to the specification and said the specification is no aid to me because this phrase, this term, is nowhere to be found in the specification. It's not defined in the specification. And that's the fact. So then the judge went to the file history. And what the judge below did is he picked certain portions of that file history that he found to be supportive of Warner Lambert's position. And as is very, I think, set forth in our brief, step by step, we go through the file history, but our position is simply this. The claim term is not ambiguous. It's plain and clear on its face. It's an anion less than 20 ppm, which is a weight measure, of an anion of a mineral acid. There's nothing ambiguous about that. This is about anions, less than 20 ppm of anions, not less than 20 ppm of mineral acids. And by the way, that phrase, anion of a mineral acid, is really a limited phrase. It's not all anions. It's anions of a certain class, the class meaning anions that are capable of forming a mineral acid.
The problem is you don't want us to read in derived from, which, you know, fine, I'm not going to, but you don't want us, then you do want us to read in capable, or capable, because the question is what does of mean, right? Is that what it comes down to? I mean, just what does the word of mean here? Because it's anion of a mineral acid, and you want me to say it's capable of being linked, and he wants me to say...
Well, that was the phrase I'm trying to explain what we think it means. It's the same as saying a metal of group 3 of the periodic table. I think that's a metal that comes from somewhere. In this case, the anion is connected to the mineral acid. It's a subset of all anions, namely an anion that comes, you know, it's capable, it's the best phrase we came up with, of forming a mineral acid, like chloride if it's hydrochloric acid, phosphate if it's phosphoric acid, so on and so forth. The specification, column 5, lines 27 to 29, it is the only place you see the language, the phrase, less than 20 ppm. And it talks about hydrochloride admixtures. That's the only thing that could arguably support this claim term, but clearly it does it, because a hydrochloride admixture is gabapentin hydrochloride.
And if the very next sentence reads, the same also applies to other mineral acids.
Correct. So, for example, if it was boron, it would be hydroboric acid. And so, if it's an admixture, in other words, hydrochloric acid is not an admixture. It's gabapentin hydrochloride. And in the context of the specification where Your Honor is looking, they're talking about the particular process that's laid out in this specification, which is, you know, they clearly make gabapentin hydrochloride. By the way, just so we're clear, bulk gabapentin, you can't have mineral acid or hydrochloric acid floating in this gabapentin. It's immediately bound, so you don't have a mineral acid floating there. I think I'm over my 2 minutes.
Yes, you are. So
I'm sorry.
Mr. Blumenfeld, how much did he have before?
He has 3 minutes, Your Honor.
So we'll give him 5.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope I won't need it all. I'd like to start with Mr. Lee's first point, and it's the only point I'll make on the pH testing. He said that Teva's own pH testing was too imprecise. But that Teva's pH tests, they were qualitative. Those are the tests that they used with the FDA. Once they had their specification set for the amount of chloride ions, they switched and used pH with the FDA. It was good enough for them to test their product for patient use. So to come in and say that data is just unreliable, it's all over the place when you've used it with the FDA, I don't think really works. On the adjuvant issue, what Judge Lifflin found was that it had to be mixed with the gabapentin, and I think that is consistent with the specification, with the file history, because in the when the specification talks about the adjuvants at the bottom column 4, the top of column 5, it specifically talks about their use in the preparation of pharmaceutical compositions. It doesn't ever talk about adjuvants in the capsule shells or in the coatings. There's not a word about that. And when you look at Dr. Tromblin's declaration, which they pointed to, it's at A659, 660 of the appendix, he has a footnote in there about the things that he's added to the gabapentin, and it says, excipient mixed with gabapentin. That's what he was talking about. TiO2 is on there. He's not talking about it being in the capsule shell. He's talking about it being mixed with the gabapentin. And the rest of what Mr. Lee said...
So are you suggesting that the judge's claim instruction below, when he said intimately mixed with gabapentin, that requires it to be only something inside the capsule shell? That's the way you understand his claim construction.
That's the way that I understood his claim construction, that it has to be mixed with the gabapentin itself. Now, the rest of what Mr. Lee was arguing sounded to me not like claim construction, but like a fact issue that, at least after today, he may want to raise if we're back on remand as to whether things are mixed with the gabapentin if they're you know, put in the coating or the shell. My understanding was that that was not the claim construction.
Well, can't they mix with the gabapentin during the digestive process?
Well, except that the claims really are directed to the stability for a year during storage. That's what the claims talk about, not what happens in the body. And I don't think that's contested by either side. On the claim construction issue, it does say an anion of a mineral acid, and claim 11 says where the mineral acid is hydrochloric acid. If they intended to say total chloride, why would they have a claim that says an anion of hydrochloric acid as opposed to just saying chloride anions? I think that the judge's construction is correct. It's not talking about total chlorides. It's used as a proxy. And you have to look at, what is this patent about? This patent isn't about gabapentin hydrochloride causing lactam formation. It's about hydrochloric acid causing lactam formation. That's what they're trying to avoid. There are three declarations in the record during prosecution history, one in 1993 from Dr. Herrmann, one in 1996 from Dr. Gebhardt, one in 1999 from Dr. Tronlin. Every one of them talks about how it's the hydrochloric acid that causes the instability, it's the hydrochloric acid that causes the lactam formation, and that you have to keep the gabapentin below 20 parts per million of hydrochloric acid measured by its anion. That's what the patent is about, and that's what the claims are about, that's what the specification's about. If you look at column 2, where it talks about how to make this, it says you add concentrated mineral acid, you create gabapentin hydrochloride, then you put it through a process to remove the hydrochloric acid. That's what was being removed. That's what was causing the problem. That's what the patent is about. Unless the court has some further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Blumenfeld. Case will be taken under advisement.